That's Harlem's Shirley Scott, the undisputed queen of the organ, the Hammond B3 to be exact, and spectacular at everything from church music to hard bop and soul. That's her opening up. In the Kitchen is the name of that tune, recorded in 1958. It's the title track of Volume 1 of Eddie Lockjaw Davis's cookbook series, and she collaborated very often with Eddie Lockjaw Davis. This is just the opening with Eddie Lockjaw Davis coming in, but not until about 5 minutes into the tune. Shirley Scott, who was also a composer and band leader and was married to saxophone phenom Stanley Turrentine, died on March the 10th, 2002, at the age of 67, 2 years after he died at the age of 66. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And developments in Chicago and South Carolina bring into sharp focus the national crisis of police killings of unarmed people. Overwhelmingly, they have been and still tend to be people of color, statistics show, and they were killed or are likely to be killed by white officers who rarely are successfully prosecuted for their crimes. So today I'll talk about how the judicial system provides deep cover for rogue cops and why efforts at reform simply won't touch the matter of criminal complicity by prosecutors and even judges who are found very often to be aiding and abetting injustice. Well, the case in Chicago basically arises out of a long history in that city of cops, rogue cops, going free after having dispatched citizens, most of them people of color, in the Windy City. Just yesterday, we had the announcement by the city of Chicago that reforms are in place for the Chicago Police Department. A watchdog, the Independent Police Review Authority, has said that it is now restructuring the city's police department. And Mayor Rahm Emanuel, as you know, under fire for just this particular issue, and there is an effort afoot to put into place provisions, legal provisions, to kick him out of office and to kick out of office any elected official, particularly at the city level and even at the state level. Right now, there's only a measure that would allow citizens to recall a governor, but none that apply to other elected officials. So that effort is underfoot because it has this matter of police killings arose to such a level that people felt that the only way to make a point, or one of the best ways to make a point, is to hold the mayor, who ultimately is responsible for the functioning of the police department. So Mayor Rahm Emanuel caving under fire over the issue of police killings just appointed someone named Sharon Fairley to act as the head of this Independent Police Review Authority, and yesterday they announced reforms. Again, I remind you that this came in the immediate aftermath of the killing of Laquan McDonald, who, as you know, was shot 16 times, and it was captured on videotape. And the nation and the world saw a public execution of that young man. Now, a couple of interesting facts here to note. This authority has the authority to look at police conduct especially in these awful cases where people's lives are claimed. It was formed in 2007. So it means that it has, or allegedly has, some idea by now, one hopes, of how the police department functions and what typically happens in these kinds of cases. Certainly, Laquan McDonald, the shooting of Laquan McDonald, and we had, following the shooting of Laquan McDonald, we had a double killing just last week of two people in the same domicile, including a 19-year-old college student and a 55-year-old woman who was trying to help his father calm him down. He was said to have mental issues and was in a state of distress at the time. We'll get to that case in a minute. But coming to this Independent Police Review Authority, which is akin to what in New York City is called the Independent Review Board. This is a board that is established to review cases in which police commit all kinds of infractions up to and including the killing of citizens. This Independent Police Review Authority announced yesterday that it was doing some reforms. Remember when we discussed this in the same vein of what does reform mean? We discussed that the U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, I played you the entire statement she made when she announced that there was going to be a review, a federal review, of the Chicago Police Department. But in that same news conference, which was not covered as news, the media covered almost all of the media. I did not see a single report that took the angle that the nation's highest authority on prosecutions, the one who is the highest level of supervision, made it clear that no person or persons would be the target of her investigation. The Department of Justice made it official at that news conference that it was just not going to investigate anybody, and certainly not with an eye toward prosecution. The Justice Department, the U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, made it very clear at that news conference that the thrust of the investigation would be reform, administrative reforms, to just make the department a little bit, more accountable in its procedures and practices. And if in the investigation, this is what they're calling an investigation, if in the course of the investigation they happen to run across a pattern, a race-based pattern of practices and policies, then they'll bring that to the department's attention, and hopefully there will be some reform. Now, that is how the U.S. Department of Justice, the highest and ultimate authority on the criminal justice system in this country, officially made it clear, and publicly so, it washed its hands of any responsibility to actually deliver justice. Instead, it committed to administrative reforms, and the public, the nation, is to interpret this as an official response to what everybody regards as a catastrophic problem, a crisis situation, and a pervasive one, one that is similar no matter where it is located, no matter where it occurs. The patterns have long been established. as the Justice Department itself knows, since it is, of course, one of the leading agency to gather this information, to analyze it, to interpret what the statistics are suggesting, and then to act on it and come up with certain, swift and certain punishment for people who break the law, even if those happen to be police officers and those in law enforcement and in the judicial system generally. Okay, so that's established. The Justice Department officially has taken a hands-off position with regard to prosecution of such individuals. Now, so locally, the fight ensues. It now is up to the state, and directly it is up to the mayor of the city of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, to get this thing under control. But it is so pervasive and is so endemic that it is not easy to tackle this problem because it is also so politically dicey. And no politician is going to march into this thorn bush in order simply to rattle the nerves of a police department locally and then begin the process, a kind of domino effect that it would have all across the nation. There's only one position to take when it comes to politics and the cops, and that is you are always, always on the side of the police. Only, and even when the evidence is there in your face, they would say, well, you can't trust your eyes in these situations. Your eyes may deceive you. There are all these other things to consider. And so when all of that is taken into consideration, we therefore must give the benefit of the doubt to the police officer. It starts off, therefore, as a lopsided legal equation. The victim or victims basically bear the burden of responsibility for their executions by police. A standard operating procedure. Well, what do you know? We have yesterday a couple of developments in the cases in Chicago, the most recent ones. We have the family of the woman who was shot. The police started out. It was beginning from the very beginning. It was reported as an accidental shooting. Accidental that she was shot. Just to give some background, the young man who was killed along with Betty Jones, Quintonio LeGreer, he was 19 years old. He apparently had had a history of a mental disorder. For whatever reason, he was agitated more so than on usual days. And he was acting erratically. His father tried to calm him down but couldn't contain him, and thought that maybe if he called for help from the police, you know, it could help restrain him, calm him down, and get him the help he needed. Okay, so he calls the police, and he advises the police of the situation. His son is having some problems, and could you come and help calm the situation down? The neighbor downstairs, Betty Jones, they lived in the same building on West Erie Street. He asked her to come upstairs. She lived on the first floor. He asked her to come upstairs and just open the door for the police when they arrive. The next thing we hear, according to news reports, was that shots were fired because Quintonio was wielding an aluminum bat and was extremely violent. He refused to obey police orders to drop the bat. Shots were fired. He is dead. However, Betty Jones, who was behind him, also is shot. And she is dead. So there was a twofer there that day. Two people dead. The first reports we got, public reports now, don't forget, in these situations, the first reports are supplied by the police. So the police spokesman did say that the shots were fired. The police officer had felt that there was a situation in which he was in danger, and so he fired and unfortunately killed the two people in the domicile. And then came the report, and the reports consistently underlined the point that the young man, Quintonio, was out of control and extremely violent at the time. And so the police responding had to do something, and unfortunately, it resulted in the use of lethal force. Well, what do we know beyond that? It turns out there's another story here. And again, this is not unusual, because in all of these cases that I have covered like this, there tend to be entirely different versions other than the version supplied by the police. Bullets were found outside. Bullet casings were found outside of the home. But the police report was that the police officer opened fire inside of the house because the young man was charging at him after he had entered the house and was attacked. And the young man was about to violently attack him with the baseball bat. Now we are hearing that the police casings, the casings from the police officer's gun, were found outside of the home, at least 20 feet outside of the front door. Now, who knows which version is to be believed? But we do know that since we have such contrasting accounts, we should be careful not to report this as a cut and dried case. And we should want to know what accounts for these entirely different versions of it. That is odd, isn't it? But the officer has not been questioned. The officer has not been required to give a statement so far as to what happened here. By union protection, as part of work benefits, by the way, there's a benefit of being a police officer negotiated by most unions with the cities that the officers work for. The benefit is, in cases in which there's a question of wrongdoing, you don't have to answer any questions. You are not committed to answering any questions for 48 hours. Now, in many cases, in many cities, that has been reworked, but in many cities, it still stands as operating procedure. The officer does not have to cooperate with an investigation. what I'm pointing to here implies that the Justice Department deliberately is overlooking this as a structural problem, a structural impediment, because technically, when a police officer is given that privilege, we have to understand it as a temporary immunity from prosecution. And to my mind, I'm not a legal expert, but to my mind, that is tantamount to a constitutional infraction there. Does a police officer, or should a police officer, get some special dispensation because he wears a badge when there is a question of the killing of a person? Should a police officer have the right to resist being questioned? Do we see a pattern in which prosecutors routinely observe that rule, whether it is on the books or not, as a kind of professional courtesy? Because you know what happens when the police officers are delayed in their answering and in their filing of reports, official reports, stories get concocted and, you know, explanations suddenly pop up that really have no relation to the truth. Which is to say, there is great reason to suspect, and this is what should be the focus of the Justice Department, to what degree do prosecutors become complicit agents in the railroading of justice? We know readily that this is evident in the way they handle grand jury investigations that are supposed to deliver indictments but mysteriously don't. We can see complicity there. Is the Justice Department going to conduct investigations nationwide, especially in those trouble spots, as they like to call them, where we see the pattern and practice of prosecutors who simply don't deliver indictments in cases where police officers have killed people, mostly people of color? Is that a thing you think should trigger an investigation in patterns and practices? Apparently, Loretta Lynch doesn't think it rises to that level. Now, here's a case in which two people are killed in a house. In the house. All right? They weren't on the sidewalk. But casings are said to have been found outside of the house, as far as 20 feet away from the house. And nobody finds it unusual that that should happen. That's an unusual thing, I think. Right there, in my reportorial experience, that right there tells me that the whole thing is suspect. The whole system that delivered that narrative is suspect. How do you find two bodies inside of a building where the police officer says the confrontation occurred inside the building? And yet the casings are outside. From the gun that the bullets came from. And presumably from other guns as well that the police had. We are clear this, the people who were dead had no guns. So they didn't do the shooting. And they certainly didn't kill themselves. And yet the media accepts this anomaly as a plausible explanation for what happened here. And the prosecutor is accepting this as a plausible explanation for what happened here. And the mayor is accepting this as a plausible explanation for what happened here. And everybody is saying, let's give everybody the benefit of the doubt and the constitutional protections, and you're innocent until proven guilty, and all this claptrap. Instead of saying, we have diametrically opposing accounts of what happened here, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. And this warrants a response on the level of a major, major problem. When people can be cut down in their homes, and we are told this kind of claptrap about how they might have died, and we know the dynamic, and we are told just the same to calm down and wait till everything is explained. And those people who, like me, are expressing some degree of agitation about this are being unreasonable. And they have to quiet down, and they have to wait for things to pan out, because as tragic as the situation is, the police officer is entitled to some degree of constitutional protections. Now, you multiply this by decades and decades of similar nonsense involving the deaths, the summary executions of thousands of people, the vast majority of whom share a racial and ethnic profile. And the vast majority of their killers similarly sharing a racial and ethnic profile. And you're going to tell me that this is not racially motivated. This has nothing to do with race. This is just a matter of sometimes very unfortunate things happening. Then I tell you, I'm not going to be among those who would say that we have to give this thing a bit more time and know all the facts. I say that the bullets on the sidewalk, said to be at least 20 feet from the front door of the house, alone should have produced an entirely different response from the system, and the system is not responding appropriately. And people now are entitled to compel it to do its job. And the job isn't here about, well, what happened? The job is to root out the cover already being provided. Killer cops, and to subject them to certain and swift punishment. Somebody's got to go to jail. And we have to see it here as the early suggestion of how a system, in a conspiratorial way, denies justice. Yes, I use the word conspiratorial because that's what happens. The different components have to work together to produce the predicted and predictable result. It doesn't happen any other way. That other than that, these mechanisms automatically synchronize. And again, on the basis of race, primarily, but also on the basis that the police are the expression of the power of the state. And in the minds of the system, it must prevail as such in the eyes of the public. The state is more powerful than you and me. I tell you, right there in Chicago, there are very important lessons to be learned, because just yesterday, a federal judge ruled that none other than the state, the city, if you will, the city corporation council, who was appointed by Rahm Emanuel. See, we keep coming to the same circles, the same system. It's a system that when he was a prosecutor, he lied. He concealed evidence in a trial involving a police officer who killed an unarmed person. He lied. Two things about this. It is being made to look by the media that this is an exceptional case. An exceptional case because it is so rare. I am going to tell you, it is not. It is routine. Prosecutors routinely lie. Because the system is stacked against those people who deserve more than anybody to have their constitutional rights to a fair trial protected. They don't get that. And certainly they don't get it very often, and most often in cases where you have a death involved, a shooting death, or in the case of Eric Garner, a chokehold death. The prosecutors lie all the time. And they're not the only ones. Judges lie. There is jury tampering. All kinds of craziness is going on in the course of prosecuting a police officer that would never, ever be allowed in a typical case were the situation reversed. The Justice Department is not interested in that. Which is where the problem is. The Justice Department said to the people, I played it for you. She made it plain, Ms. Loretta Lynch. I am not interested in prosecuting any person or persons. I'll just take a look at, you know, administrative stuff to help them tighten it up. And yet we have looming in front of her and in front of all of us the big problem. The criminal justice system, it's a strange combination of words. It's both insightful and indicting at the same time, because the criminals are in the so-called justice system. That's where you find a lot of criminality. It's official. They have titles like district attorney and corporation counsel and all of this kinds of stuff. But there is systemic injustice and wrongdoing going on there all across the country. And especially in cases involving police killings, the system goes into automatic mode, justice denial mode. You won't get it. It's not available. The cops prevail. That's the law, and they make it so. So this Corporation Counsel he is now. Senior Corporation Counsel, actually, is his title. He's a very important guy in Rahm Emanuel's administration. And he's been working for the city of Chicago since 1997. But yesterday, U.S. District Judge Edmund Chang wrote a scathing report of his own. He overturned the verdict in a case in which the family of Darius Pinnex, a young man who was killed by a police officer, filed a lawsuit demanding, if you will, compensation and reparations, but also an investigation of this thing, and found that in the course of the trial, it was none other than the current, or now he's ex, senior corporation counsel who lied and denied pivotal information that would have resulted in the indictment and conviction of the police officers. This is how high it goes. And again, this is not exceptional. This is routine and pervasive and systemic and endemic. It's a pandemic of corruption that has been allowed to stand. And the criminals in this case will include prosecutors, judges, lawyers, you know, people who went to fine schools and earned great salaries. I reference the employment of the senior corporation counsel, Jordan Marsh, working for the city of Chicago since 1997. This man has been able to draw a rather handsome salary all those years. But the judge says he's a liar. The judge says he's a corrupter of justice. The judge says this corporation counsel, who apparently is charged with putting a whole bunch of people in jail, he probably did, probably sent hundreds of people in jail, earning a very nice penny at taxpayer expense and doing this kind of dirty work. He's dirty, says a federal judge. And I tell you, this is not an exceptional person. This is not an exceptional case. This lawyer for the city, according to the judge, he says this in his opinion, 72 pages he wrote. He says that the time has come to serve a lesson. Attorneys who might be tempted to bury late surfacing information need to know that if discovered, any verdict they win will be forfeit and their clients will pay the price. They need to know it is not worth it. Crime in high places and perfectly routine. This is not, again, this is not a departure from the norm. This is the norm. This is the norm. So, here's a question. What are we going to do? I raise these questions because the city of Chicago is the home of a powerful set of leaders. They're not interested in tackling this. They're not interested in removing Rahm Emanuel. Jesse Jackson is in Chicago. I talked about Jesse yesterday. And why it is important to make these links, because we miss the point all the time. Yesterday I started in South Carolina, and I told you how significant it is that the battleground in 2016 for Hillary Clinton, the Democratic so-called front runner, the battleground is South Carolina, one of the first states to have early voting in this presidential contest. And it was in South Carolina that Jesse Jackson made such an impressive victory, both in 1984 and 1988, when he ran under the Rainbow Coalition banner. Rainbow Coalition, I remind people, was not Jesse Jackson's creation. It was Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers who created the concept. But of course, it has been arrogated by the wily Jackson, who seeks to basically use it as the hub of a personal business enterprise covered by the idea that he's interested in civil rights. But if we had honest, committed leadership back then, when Jesse Jackson in 1988 garnered almost 7 million votes, 7 million votes. He didn't win, but we don't care about winning in the way people define winning. We know that he was the first, the most significant campaign. He was not the first candidate to run, African-American candidate. Shirley Chisholm did that. But his campaign was able to run nationally because people sweated and worked hard, believing that he actually meant what he said and that he was truly committed to the idea of people of similar stripes coming together of all races and forming a formidable opposition to this corrupt duopoly and gaining inroads. So I'm saying that in 1988, we had 7 million votes to start with. But of course, the idea was to transform those 7 million votes as a ticket to personal gain. To bring 7 million votes as your qualifier for preferential treatment and personal reward from the Democratic Party, when in 2016, the state that you won in 1984 and 1988, I'm talking about South Carolina, he won 11, some people say 13, depending on how you count, primaries. That's quite significant. That's quite significant, considering it was a spit and chewing gum operation. There was no big set of money going on there. It was guts. It was hard work. It was belief. It was faith. It was identification with a shared purpose. And it certainly was a recognition of the need to continue the fight that had begun before you got on the scene. And I reference Fannie Lou Hamer here and others. But by 2016, if we go back to 1984, 1988, by 2016, there should be and should have been a system in place, a political alternative to this nonsense that we have to deal with, a system that has been given all this time to perfect itself. in its methods of control and domination and annihilation of undesirables. From 1984, 1988 to 2016, there should be at this moment not an opportunity to campaign for Hillary Clinton in South Carolina, but she should come up against a formidable, organized political opposition in South Carolina. Where is it? Where is it? There is nothing available as a hammer to extract concessions from anybody. It's just talk. And the talk usually is about what you want, what you need. Could we please get? Would you please give? You have nothing. You have no political weapons. And I contend it's not accidental either. That movement that was built with sweat, with commitment, with a deep desire for change was hijacked. And people still have not reclaimed it. They allowed him to just walk away with it. And systematically wield it as a cudgel, but not for aggregate progress and benefit, but for personal gain. So whereas in South Carolina, this is why I started in South Carolina, and again, here we have every reason to connect another dot. Because you may recall that it was in South Carolina that Walter Scott was shot dead by a police officer. Remember Walter Scott, the young man who was said to be running away from a police officer after a traffic stop? And he was shot, most of the bullets in the back. And what happened there? The police officer who shot him and killed him was released from jail just yesterday. There's no cudgel to force the system to behave differently. We come back to square one. And it is about pleading for a system that has no heart to suddenly develop one. This is a new year. I keep repeating myself because it's important that the message gets through. We are seeing the signs of a growing genocidal temperament. People may say I'm exaggerating. You're free to do so. Free to say so if you want. But that's how I feel. It is genocidal. And I believe that I could prove my point just by statistics. No other community is suffering this problem the way the African American and Latino communities are. Simple as that. Communities of color, Native Americans, we're all lumped together. Poor whites. No other communities are suffering this problem. And yet, we don't see an organized response. And we see, however, wasted opportunity and useless investment in people who don't qualify for leadership. And who should be called out? I had called before, many years ago, for a public declaration of no faith in certain people, cancel their policies publicly. Announce to the world you no longer recognize them as leaders. If somehow they are gaining traction in those areas that look to traitors and people interested in self as the ambassadors to distressed communities, publicly cancel their authority. Publicly denounce them. Publicly call them out. Until we do that, we too will have to claim responsibility for our own treatment. Until we become very vocal and very aggressive. My phrasing years ago used to be, ruthless and obsessive about our interests. Until we do that, we will not be taken seriously. And so we already see the evidence of our failures, because we have a Hillary Clinton who today is a leading candidate to run this country. I don't ascribe that to her prowess. I describe that to our unwillingness to make sure that that doesn't happen, that we accept mediocrity. We accept better than what we deserve. We accept that. Worse than what we deserve. We accept that. We accept that. And we go along with it. And then we expect that things should be improving. As if you don't know by now how this system works. So, I leave it here for you today, connecting some dots. They seem completely separate from each other. But when you come from and you recognize that you do come from or you do belong to an oppressed community, you are therefore more attuned to these things than others. And you have a duty to be, because your survival depends upon it. Making sense of the world. You make sense of the world by connecting the dots. I thank you so much for listening. I'd like to hear from you at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking and share your thoughts. And I thank those of you who are studying in your Lead Stories clubs. Thank you so much for that, for forming them. They're just a group of people who listen to the program and listen to other programs on PRN.FM, and they call each other up and they figure out what it is they want to talk about, and they share information based on programs aired here. And it's fantastic peer education. It is what is needed. And it is a wonderful way to broaden and deepen your view of the world, your reservoir of information. We will need it. We really will need that in this year and in years to come. I also urge you to support PRN.FM. This station is becoming more and more vital for independent information that helps you, that respects your intellect and helps you make sense of the world by presenting to you information that you would not get anyplace else. So if you can, please do support PRN.FM and certainly PRN's favorite program, of course, Lead Stories. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to stay tuned for that. And we'll see each other tomorrow. In the meantime, please know from me, sincerely, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Thank you. See you tomorrow.